Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 11, Episode 11. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing not one, not two, not four tales to terrify you, but eight, courtesy of author Micah Edwards. Tonight, you'll hear tales of odd churches, unusual shortcuts, malevolent mists, a match made in heaven, road work, worse than normal. A match made in hell, bad birthdays, and mental anxieties. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first four spine-tingling stories. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com. and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Some say you can't go home again. That's a load of hogwash. Of course you can go home again. I've done it several times myself, even when the new occupants didn't take too kindly to me barging in. But they're more accepting now that we've had a few chats. That said, it's not that you can't physically come home again, but that's one homecoming that may not be as wonderful as expected. Though some things don't always change, like that church that never seems to have any parishioners. Without further ado, I present to you what's going on at Liberty Chapel. I'm from a smallish town. In a town like that, you know everybody's business, for better or for worse. You all go to the same school, shop at the same stores, show up on Sundays at the same churches. More or less, anyway. My town had 5 churches. We had a Methodist church, where my family went. We had a Lutheran church for folks who meant well. We had 2 Baptist churches from some schism a half century back that no one was willing to talk about yet. And then there was Liberty Chapel. It was an attractive little place from the outside, covered in clean white siding, surrounded by neatly trimmed grounds, and topped with an elegant yet modest bell tower. Out front, there were a lot of churches that just had the interchangeable letter signs. Liberty Chapel had a nice brickwork piece surrounding an electronic sign to display the church's events. For some reason, though, all it ever said was, "What is going on at Liberty Chapel?" Nothing else. There were never any events listed, no times for services, no calls to worship at Easter, no food drives or community outreach opportunities. Just those 7 words, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Those words shone out onto the nearby street. The funny thing was, I never knew anyone who went to Liberty Chapel. I knew all of the Methodists, obviously, and a good chunk of the Lutherans. A bunch of my friends were Baptists of one congregation or the other. There was even a Jewish family in town for a while, though they moved away after a few years. Point is, I knew where people went. We all knew each other's business, like I said. And I didn't know anyone who went to Liberty Chapel. Somehow, it wasn't until I left town to go to college that this struck me as unusual. It wasn't until I was back for summer break after my sophomore or junior year that it really hit me. I was nearly home, smelling the familiar smells and looking forward to a visit with my family before going off to work for the summer, when I drove past Liberty Chapel. The walls were clean and white as always, the bushes and grass carefully trimmed, and yet that sign still blared out its single, unchanging message. What is going on at Liberty Chapel? That day, for some reason, I really wanted to know the answer. So I turned into the small lot, parked my car, and walked up to the front doors of the church. I felt somehow like I should knock, but I quashed the impulse. It was a church, after all. They welcomed people, right? So I opened the door and poked my head inside. It was cool within and brighter than I'd expected. Large windows let in great shafts of light, giving it a welcoming, comfortable feel. Row upon row of empty pews stretched up toward the tabernacle at the front, and the space felt bigger inside than the humble outside had suggested. But although the space was able to house a sizable crowd, I was completely alone. "Hello?" I called out hesitantly, my voice echoing in the empty chamber. Far away, I heard the soft squeak of a door opening, and then footsteps padding toward me. Soon after, a slightly hunched figure came into view, peering around the corner. It was Dr. Arbogast, the old man who had been in charge of Liberty Chapel for as long as I could remember. He was the preacher, caretaker, and landscaper, all rolled into one. Frankly, I was a little surprised to see him still running the place. I remembered him as being old when I was a child. Yet he was clearly still spry and able to continue his one-man operation. "Yes, can I help you?" He smiled as he approached, holding out his hand to me to shake. I took his hand in mine. His skin felt papery and delicate, his bones almost bird-like. "Yeah, I don't know. I just realized that I'd never been in here, and I kind of wanted to take a look." "Come on in," he beamed, gesturing for me to follow him. "I'll show you around." I followed him down the aisle, his shuffling pace, somehow managing to cover the distance, at a reasonable rate of speed. I looked around at the wooden pews, the stained glass windows, the table covered in white linen and set with candles. It all looked so normal, like every other church I'd been in. So then why did it have no parishioners? Reverend Arbogast, what denomination are you? I asked. He waved a hand at me. Not reverend, please. That's much too grand. Shepherd, if you would. Shepherd Arbogast? Indeed, indeed, he chuckled. A much more apt term. I'm no reverend. Clay, the same as everyone. I just have a job to do. We passed the altar, and he led me down a short hallway to his office. I took a seat in a chair that he motioned to. Would you like a glass of water? You look parched. Shepherd Arbogast asked, and I nodded. It was a full summer's day outside, and the AC was out in my car. Even driving with the windows down could only do so much. Arbogast disappeared around the corner for a moment, and I heard the sound of running water. He came back with a tall glass of water with condensation already beating on the outside and passed it to me. I took a deep draft, enjoying the chill of the water against the heat of my throat. It's from our well, said the shepherd. Same as I fill the fountain with. I won't say it's got restorative properties, but it certainly has kept me young. He laughed, the wrinkles on his face creasing, and I laughed with him. Then he started to talk something about the church's history, but my attention was drawn to a plain wooden door behind him. Said as it was, it should have led just about to the outside, but I didn't remember any door on that side of the church. Maybe it was just a closet. Possibly, but the door bore a lock more appropriate to secure an office building, maybe even a vault of some kind. With Arbogast, the only person here, what could he possibly need such a lock for? Anything in particular you'd like to ask about? Arbogast asked, startling me from my reverie. I cast about for something that would suggest that I'd been paying attention. What's with the sign out front? I asked. It only ever displays that same message. The shepherd laughed. We had that installed in the 90s. The man who put it in showed me everything it could do, all the options it had, and set up the basic screen for me. Then he left, and I promptly lost the remote that let me program it. It said the same thing ever since. I kind of like it this way, to be honest. I think it inspires people to think about us. But no one ever comes here, I said, then regretted it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude. No, no, you're right, said the shepherd, smiling slightly. It's not yet our time. But I have faith that the time will come, and my congregation will rise and stand with me to meet the Lord. I wished him luck, shook his fragile hand again, and was on my way. When I walked out the door, I thought that was the last of my interaction with Liberty Chapel. But all that night, while I was greeted back at home, and the joyful chaos of family roiled around me, my thoughts kept drifting back to that plain wooden door behind the shepherd's desk. I decided that evening to go back the next day and ask him about it, to put my curiosity to rest. But as I lay myself to bed that night, I couldn't put the door out of my mind. It was just so out of place, out of character, for the rest of the small chapel. And what if it was something interesting? There was no chance that Shepherd Arbogast would just confess. With no congregation, how had he kept the church going all those years? Maybe the answer was behind that door. Some thoughts only make sense in the dead of night, which is how I found myself, creeping down the streets of my hometown dressed in dark clothing, a crowbar concealed up one sleeve of my sweatshirt. I told myself that I just needed a quick peek, that I wouldn't take anything, but I had to know what was behind that door. The church doors opened slightly at my touch, and for the second time that day, I found myself walking down its aisle. The silent pews lined up in serried ranks beside me. I took the turn to the shepherd's office, moving by the moonlight shining in through the tall windows. At the door to his office, I froze, standing motionless. I could hear a faint, steady sound, a far-off murmuring. I waited for a minute or more, listening to it, but it never came clear or increased in volume. Finally, I gathered my courage and moved forward into the office. To my surprise, the locked door was ajar. I stole around the desk to peer inside and found that it led to a narrow niche with a long metal ladder leading down. A faint, wavering light shone up from below, casting a subtle bluish tinge over the carpet. Leaning over the ladder, the distant murmur intensified. It was clearly coming from below. Although this was nothing like what I expected to find, I'd come too far to turn back now. I leaned my crowbar up against the wall, slid past the door, into the shallow nook, and made my way silently down the ladder. I traveled down for what felt like 100 feet or more. The walls surrounding me were earth and stone, clearly were hand-carved. And when at last the shaft I was in widened, it opened onto an enormous natural cavern, softly lit by blue light strung along its ceiling. At first I thought more lights lined the floor, but I abruptly realized that I was looking at the reflection from an immense, perfectly still lake. The ladder led out at one side of the cavern. On the far side, glowing in a blue nimbus, was a lectern, behind which stood Shepherd Arbogast. He was reading from a book that was open before him, and although the echoes in the cavern distorted his voice and made the words difficult to understand, I caught occasional lines about redemption, judgment, and resurrection. Keeping to the shadows as best I could, I crept carefully forward, trying to hear more. I had only made it a few steps, though, when Arbogast's voice rang out clear as a bell, echoing across the waters. "I thought you'd be back." I froze, unsure what to do. "Be not afraid," he continued. "You're here because you're meant to be here. Look upon the answers you sought. See my congregation." He spread his hands wide, encompassing the entire cavern in his gesture. For a moment I thought it was delusional, but then I glanced down at the waters and my breath caught my throat. Although I had at first seen only the reflection of the lights in the water, from my current vantage point I was able to see into the lake itself. The still waters were crystal clear, allowing me to see all the way to the bottom, dozens of feet below. And there, standing in orderly rows, stretching all the way to the far side of the cavern, were corpses. Thousands upon thousands of corpses, perfectly preserved by the icy waters, all dressed in their Sunday best, all standing at mute attention, listening with eternal patience to the shepherd's speech. I fled back up the ladder then, paying no attention to the words the shepherd shouted after me. I ran back to my family's house, collected my bags, and left that night. I called them later to apologize and made up an excuse about an emergency. What could I tell them? That a preacher in town had been robbing the graveyards to build a congregation of the dead? That I'd seen Grandpa in there, standing near the back dressed in the suit we'd buried him in? Or worse, the thing I'd tell myself I could not have seen, could not have happened, that I did not just happen to catch sight of Grandpa, that he turned his head toward me, his milky, sightless gaze searching in my direction, that he had raised one hand limply in those icy waters and beckoned gently for me to join him. I will never in my life return to that town, but I'm haunted by the half-heard sermon of the Shepherd Arbogast, and I'm deeply afraid that, run though I might, I may end up there after I die.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
I hope you enjoyed What's Going On at Liberty Chapel by Micah Edwards, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/authors/Micah-Edwards. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/authors/MICAH-EDWARDS. He has his subreddit you can follow, or his WordPress website, or a variety of books you can choose from, like A Nice Evening at the Borgia Residence. You can look around and pick your poison. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. I've often heard of dead congregations, but usually it's just referring to the state of the coffee and donut meet and greets afterwards. We now go from the depths of a forbidden ritual to that one friend who just always seems to be one step ahead, be it in life or looks or in things you really wish you didn't know about. We're about to follow, in more ways than one, a fellow who just seems to get where he's going before anyone else. It's just a matter of how. Without further ado, I present to you David Knows a Shortcut. There were three things everyone could tell you about David. The first, the one everyone noticed immediately, was that he was handsome, like Hollywood handsome. He had a roguish charm, too, a disarming smile that lit up his face and made everything all right. Men, women, it didn't matter. Everyone liked David. It was impossible to stay mad at. The second thing was that he was obsessed with his watch. He couldn't go 10 minutes without checking the time. To his credit, it was a nice watch. I don't know anything about watches, but I could tell that it was sleek and well-made. Judging by the reactions of folks who did know and care about watches, though, I got the feeling that it was more than just something you'd pick up at the mall. David wasn't ever ostentatious about his watch. He wasn't wearing it to show off. He just looked at it a lot. Folks commented on it sometimes, asking him if there was somewhere he had to be, that sort of thing. David always just shrugged and said he had no internal clock and he liked to know what time it was. Then he'd grin and everyone would grin along with him. David's grin made you feel like you were in on a joke with him, something secret from everyone else. Charisma, like I said. The third thing everyone knew about David was that he knew a shortcut. Didn't matter where he was or where he was going, he knew a shortcut. Going to the movies? David would meet you at the theater. He knew a shortcut. Friend's housewarming party? See you there. He knew a shortcut. Interstate road trip to the middle of nowhere? David knew a shortcut. The damnable thing was that he was always right, too. No matter where we were going, David would be there first, leaning on his car, waiting for us, or already inside. He was never a jerk about it. He'd even explain the shortcuts if you asked. It's just that they never seemed to work out for anyone but him. Sure, they'd shave a minute or so off if you were lucky, if you caught the traffic lights right and didn't get stuck at a left turn. But for David, they worked every single time. David, of course, just shrugged it off. Just lucky, I guess, he'd say, and grin. That grin should have been classified as a superpower. He could get away with anything with that. No one was ever allowed along with David on his shortcuts. He had a million excuses. He was low on gas, couldn't afford the extra weight. He'd spilled something rancid on his passenger seats. His AC was out. The radio was stuck on talk radio at maximum volume. Local vandals had superglued his doors shut, and he'd only gotten the driver's door open so far. Most of the excuses weren't particularly believable, but we all just figured that David liked to drive alone. He was a little idiosyncratic, but he was a good guy, and no one cared that much most of the time. Sometimes it grated a bit. He wouldn't ever give anyone a ride to parties, saying that he liked to leave on his own schedule. He never picked up anyone from the airport. One time my car wouldn't start when I had a job interview. I called him and begged for a ride, or even just to borrow his car, but he refused. Said two tires had been slashed, and he had to get them replaced. But I knew it was just the same old refusal. I called a cab, showed up late, and didn't get the job. Next time I saw David, I was ready to chew him out, but I noticed that he had two new tires in his car. "Scoping out my new Bridgestones?" David asked with a smile, as if knowing he'd caught me checking out on his excuse. And I grinned along because I'd been caught, as if I had done something wrong. Overall, though, David was a great guy, one of those friends that you can just always talk to. He was equally there for casual bar chatter or serious life conversations, and he always knew when to crack jokes, when to offer advice, and when to just listen. So, when I got the call that my mother had been in an accident and was on her way to the hospital, it was David I called. David, please, you've got to come get me. I begged him when he answered the phone. I've got to get to the hospital. Please, it's my mother. Whoa, what happened? Car accident. She was in town visiting, and she was borrowing my car. Please, David, I don't think she's going to make it. I know you can get me there in time. You always know a shortcut, David. Please. I was babbling. I didn't care. I had to get there. The policeman on the phone had said that the paramedics were doing everything they could for her, which did not sound positive at all. Listen, David's voice cracked out the phone like a whip, shocking me into a silence. I'm on my way to you. You need to answer me this. Is this the most important thing in your life? David, it's my mother. Don't lifetime me here. This isn't about your mother, it's about you. After she dies, she won't know whether you were there or not. Is it that important to you that you be there? Is this the most important thing in your life? Answer me truthfully. You can't take this back. I paused, choking back the instinct to just blurt out another affirmative without thinking. Yes. It is. I'm outside. I tore open the door and there he was, impossible though that was. I didn't ask questions, I just jumped into the passenger seat of his car and gave him the name of the hospital. David backed out of the driveway and sped off down the street. Thank you, David, so much. I can't ever... Shut up, David said, his eyes locked in the road. There are things I need to tell you and we're not going to have a lot of time. I need you to listen like your life depends on it, because it does. He took a left into another neighborhood, then a right down a residential street. A cul-de-sac loomed ahead of us. The garage of one of the houses was open, its interior dark. David gave the car more gas. Keep your eyes straight ahead, David said. Don't look at me. You're about to see a lot of terrible things. Looking at me will be worse. He accelerated. Car scraping briefly as it bumped over the lip of the driveway. We flew into the garage, its shadow swallowing us. I slammed my eyes shut as I braced for impact, scrabbling frantically for any sport I could find. The crash never came. I eased my eyes open to find we were speeding down a road of unmarked asphalt. The sky around us was gray and uninviting, and the world wrapped in a dismal fog that obscured vision after a few dozen feet. Where? I began, turning to look at David. Eyes ahead, David snarled. His voice seemed to come from all around me, and I could feel warm breath lapping over my shoulders as he talked. I flinched and snapped my face back toward the windshield. You'll get there in time, he said. His words wrapped around me as if I were hearing them from the inside of his mouth. And the price you pay is that you will never truly leave here. Outside, ragged figures lined the road, twisted humanoid shapes with too many eyes and not enough bones. We sped past them, but more and more were clustering as we drove. They began to spill onto the road, forcing David to swerve to avoid their touch of the outstretched hands, to dodge collisions with their lumpen bodies. "Who are they?" I asked. "You need to buy a watch," David said, ignoring me. "A mechanical watch, not something dependent on electricity and internet. Something that cannot fail while even the most basic rules of physics hold true. Own your internal clock. Keep your watch precisely wound, and when it begins to slip, it's time to leave. You can't stay ahead of them if you never relax." The road arced away from the ground at an impossible angle. It twisted upward, but it also somehow turned inside out as it went, or possibly reversed. I can't explain it. It hurt my eyes to look at it. When I closed them, it left after images on my mind. Dancing spots of corrosion burned into my thoughts. I felt the car lurch through the twist. I heard David hiss, felt the sibilance on my entire body like a tongue. I kept my eyes shut and tried not to think of what I'd seen. The car steadied. David resumed speaking as if nothing had happened. "This is the last time I'll see you. Two in one place brings them sooner and in greater force. It's unsafe." Although his voice was all around me, it was becoming difficult to hear him. A faint, shrill piping was growing in my awareness. Quiet, though it was somehow managing to drown him out. I pictured the pipers, mad, capering shapes, hurling themselves through an insane dance, forms that I'd never seen nor wanted to see again. I opened my eyes, and they were surrounding the car just as I had pictured them. Their faces were warped, monstrous. Their eyes bled secrets and insanity. Their pipes were alive, moving to their own music. I felt the urge to unbuckle my seatbelt to open the door to join them. The fog ahead of us darkened, tightening around us. The pipers fell away, their dance carrying them off to unseen mysteries. I started to crane my neck to follow them, but I felt David's rank breath on my neck and managed to keep my gaze forward. The light fled from the world around us, pitching us into utter darkness. For an instant, everything was gone. I could not hear David nor feel the car. My mind still sagged under the impossibility of the road, and I wondered what had happened to me as I had been through it. Was I now one of the formless things abandoned by the roadside? Would I take up my place among the pipers? And then we were careening down a cement ramp, tires shrieking in the echo chamber of the hospital parking garage. David slid to a halt just outside of the elevator. "Go," he said. "You're in time." I tumbled out of the car, turning back to look at him. It was normal, looking just as he always had. No sign of whatever I'd felt in the car. He gave me a small wave as he leaned over to pull my door shut. "It's been good knowing you," David said. He gave me his trademark grin. "Good luck." The elevator ride took eons. The wait to the front desk, while they located my mother, was an eternity. There was a doctor there when I arrived saying something, but I didn't hear him. I knelt at her bedside and took her hand. The tubes connected to her alien under my grasp. "I'm here." She saw me. She smiled. She said my name. And she died. The machine screamed. The doctors and nurses rushed around, wheeling my mother away. I just sat there, and they let me sit. After a while, I felt someone else enter the room. They approached slowly, as if worried about disturbing me. "What do you need?" I asked, not looking up. There was no answer except the shuffling of feet as they drew slowly closer. "Do you need..." Fear drove me to my feet as I looked up to see one of the ragged figures from the road advancing on me. My chair tumbled away behind me, crashing to the ground as I staggered away. The thing spoke not a word as it approached. It merely reached out as it drew near, its rubbery fingers grasping plaintively for my flesh. I threw medical supplies, furniture at it, but nothing slowed its steady progress. I tore open a door at the back of the room, but it was only a small closet. I was trapped, pinned, The creature blocked my exit. In desperation, I cramped myself into the closet, hoping to at least buy another few moments. I could still hear its soft footsteps outside, though they were nearly drowned out by the hammering of my heart. And then, quietly, I heard another noise, subtle, drifting in on a faraway wind, but there, the sound of piping. There was a slight motion behind me, not of something in my space, but of space itself. I thought of the painful inversion of the road and I smiled. I stepped deeper down through an indescribable path. The walls unfolded around me. I began to run. I knew a shortcut. I hope you enjoyed David Knows the Shortcut by Micah Edwards, as performed by yours truly. You know, that road does seem a little familiar. I think I once saw a street lined with mutant monster shapes, but to be fair, it was late. And I did just eat some hamburgers that may have had some tainted special sauce. Or maybe I'm thinking of that drive through Saskatchewan. Either way. Well, as I look out my window, I can see the weather's getting a little misty. I think I may have a little bit of fog rolling in. Hopefully, it's not like the weather we'll encounter in our third story. That stuff can really mess with your mind if you let it. At least, hopefully, that's the worst that'll happen. Without further ado, I present to you The Murk. Obadiah had 40 different words for fog. From his fishing shack on the waterfront, he watched various fogs come and go, ebbing and flowing around the town. He needed every one of the words to describe the various types that ran their blurry touch over the island. There was the mist, the slight tendrils of cloud just barely wrapping around the houses. That one was so omnipresent that folks rarely even bothered to note it. Most of the town was mist-touch at any given time. The moments where you could see clearly end-to-end were the real rarities. Obadiah had no word for that kind of weather. It had never seemed worth it. There were the pea soupers, the thick, deep fogs that ate the sound and blocked out all sight more than an arm's length away. They rolled in on the regular, removing the rest of the town from view, and giving Obadiah the impression that he lived on an island the size of his three rooms. If the windows weren't sealed, it was even less than that, as the fog seeped in through the cracks and hid even the corners of his own house from him. In between the two extremities were the Mousters, the Corey Wonders, the Bellsmiths, and dozens more. Obadiah knew every sort of fog the sea could cough up and had names for them all. 70 years of waterfront living would do that to a man, which made this fog all the more unusual. It wasn't like any other he'd ever seen. It crawled along the ground in slow waves, gently rolling along paths and around corners like it was looking for something. It didn't spread out evenly either, but clumped together in great dense folds. Parts of it were nearly transparent, while others seemed almost solid. Despite its intermittent thinness, it muffled sound as well as the thickest fog Obadiah had ever seen. The whole house felt wrapped in cotton batting. The lapping of the sea, the creaking of the dock, the mournful calls of the birds, all of these, the background of Obadiah's life, were gone. It's this sepulchral silence that kept him staring out the window. He told himself he was just casually watching, but the truth was that he needed to keep an eye on the world to reassure himself that it was still there. A booming knock sounded at the front door. Obadiah startled from his chair, the sudden sound no less concerning than the silence that had preceded it. He craned his neck to try to see along his front porch, but the drifting fog and awkward angle kept him from getting a good view. The knock came again. Obadiah headed for the front door, taking up his stout oaken stick as he did so. If it was a neighbor who needed help outside, he'd be happy to have the extra support to keep his footing in the thick fog. And if it turned out to be someone who meant him ill, he could still hand out a pretty good wallop. A third time, the knock. "I'm coming," called Obadiah, his voice abnormally loud in the silent house. "Who is it anyway?" "Me, Obi," came the muffled reply. He cocked his head. Sounded a bit like Isabel, the neighbor woman. Nice woman, lovely young mother, but not the sort to just drop by randomly, especially not in weather such as this. "What do you need?" he asked, opening the door. To his surprise, the battered wooden porch stood empty. The rocking chair creaked gently next to the door, but only the wind was stirring it. "Your help!" Isabel's voice drifted up from the bottom of the steps. Obadiah squinted into the fog. It was swirling thickly here, obscuring even the railing post beside the stairs. He could make out a humanoid figure, but no more. What is it, Isabel? Maybe she needed his help finding a lost animal. Maybe she'd gotten lost herself. You need to come in? He took a step back, holding the door open, but the fog-shrouded figure shook her head. No, I need your help. Can you come down here? Obadiah hesitated. Something was off about her voice, though he couldn't quite put his finger on what it was. Still, if she needed help, he wasn't about to turn her down. "Let me get my coat," he said. "You don't need it. Please, hurry." The air was chillier than he liked, but if Isabel was that desperate, he could handle the discomfort. Surely she only needed him for a short time, if she was encouraging him to go out coatless. With a sigh and a shrug, he stepped out onto the porch and closed the door behind him. The fog had thickened again. Everything was a uniform shade of gray. Even the bottom step was hidden from view now. Obadiah gripped the railing with his left hand and his walking stick in his right, carefully stepping down the weathered steps. "Isabel," he called, unable to see her through the fog. "Right here," came the reply. He took a few tentative steps toward the sound. "No, over this way." The voice was now to the left of him. He edged forward again, but still saw nothing. "Where are you?" "I'm here." Her soft tones came from the right of him now. "I can see you. Just walk toward me." Two more steps, and there was still nothing there. "Girl, are you playing games with me?" "Never, Obi." But there was laughter in his voice, not the kind sort either. "All right, enough of this. Nothing better to do than taunt an old man? I'm going back inside," he grumbled. "How do you plan to do that?" Obadiah took several steps forward, expecting to see his house swim into view. It did not. There was nothing but an endless gray wall. He stopped, befuddled. Must have gotten turned around in this. He turned back and tried the other direction, but found nothing there either. The fog swirled hungrily at his legs, hiding his feet from view. Isabel's voice rang out from all around him, laughing gaily, shifting positions with every sentence. "This way." "No, over here." "You're close." "Right here." "Obi." This one practically a breath in his ear. "Enough!" He whirled, striking out with his walking stick, but the heavy wood swished uselessly through the air. Obadiah staggered and nearly fell as the momentum tugged him to the side. The fog fluttered in its wake, forming curlicues and winked and smiled before vanishing into the main mass. "Try again," whispered Isabel's voice, clearly mocking though she was. Obadiah settled his grip on the cudgel and took her advice. He struck out blindly, swinging from shoulder to hip in a repeated X shape. The laughter rose around him, mocking as he hit nothing but air over and over again. But Obadiah gritted his teeth and continued. With every strike, he took a small step and made a quarter turn. Swoosh, swoosh went the stick. And the circle Obadiah walked in grew steadily larger. He may not know which way his house was, but he knew it had to be close if he just maintained the pattern. Suddenly, the stick collided with something solid with a resounding crack. The impact charred the walking stick from his hands, sending it spinning off into the fog. Obadiah reached out with desperate fingers and grasped the wooden rail that topped his porch's newel post. He wrapped his arms around it, grabbing it like a drowning man seizing hold of a piece of floating wreckage. "Wait!" called Isabel as Obadiah hauled himself up the three stairs to his porch, one hand always maintaining a strong grip on the railing. "I'm still out here, Obi. I still need your help." He shook his head. "No, you aren't."
"Look!"
And then, in a voice quieter and more tremulous than before,
"Obi, is that you?"
He looked over his shoulder. Behind him, a path had cleared in the fog, the mists shifting aside to make a brief corridor. At the end of it, 50 yards away or more, stood Isabel. She looked confused and afraid. She appeared to have been crying.
"Obi, help!"
She took a running step toward him, and then the mists fell over her, all over again, consuming her.
"See?"
Isabel's voice again, though Obadiah knew well it was not her. "She needs your help." Obadiah shook his head once more. "All I can do if I go out there is give you another voice to play with, and I don't even have my coat."
"Wait!"
called the voice once more. But Obadiah was already at his front door, opening it to step into the safety of his house. Fog swirled in with him, but it dissipated quickly when the solid wood slammed shut behind it, tiny wisps of cloud vanishing against the carpet runner. The knocking started again, loud and insistent. Obadiah, ignoring it, walked slowly around the house, checking the latch on each window and then pulling thick curtains to block out the view and muffle the sound. He turned on the record player, settled into his chair, and let the scratchy sounds of a trumpet flow over him. He could still hear the knocking in the background, but he figured it would give up soon enough when it realized he couldn't be lured back out. Soft cries could be heard behind the trumpet now, the sounds of a young woman in distress.
"You can still save her,"
whispered a voice clustered outside his windows. Obadiah dragged his chair over closer to the record player and increased the volume. He'd seen too many men swept overboard in storms to wonder if Isabel could really be rescued. All you could do by jumping after them was add another death to the tally. "A murk," he said out loud. "That's a good name for it. A murk." The fog would pass. They all did eventually. He'd go find Isabel after that, if there was anything left of her to find. I hope you enjoyed The Murk by Micah Edwards, as performed by yours truly. On the plus side, I believe that story helped clear the weather right up. The mist outside seems to be pulling away. I just hope it doesn't leave anything behind that shouldn't be there. It was a mess the last time that happened. Sometimes, if we're lucky, we find someone we can spend the rest of our lives with. Such is the case in our next story, in which what looked like a solitary existence in a ramshackle old mansion might turn out to be a scene of wedded bliss, just as long as the past doesn't get in the way. Without further ado, I present to you The Depths of Trust. It had been a whirlwind romance. Akamaya Morrison had been head over heels for Delilah from the moment he first laid eyes on her. He was not greatly skilled in the art of seduction, or even in conversation, so it took a few tries to get her to notice him in return. Once she did, though, Delilah quickly warmed to him as well, flattered by the attention lavished upon her by this awkward, earnest man. They made an odd couple, her in high fashion gowns and him in suits handed down by generations long dead. No one expected it to last for long, least of all, Akamaya. Everyone assumed she would break his heart He would retreat back to his ancestral home on the hill, and they would go back to seeing him only during his monthly trips to the market. After all, it was clear what he saw in her, but what did she see in him? Some speculated that she was after money, but everyone knew that Morrison's wealth had long since run out. Akamaya was the last scion, and the sprawling, ramshackle estate of the Ramparts represented most of what he had left. The house and grounds were falling into disrepair. They'd likely last as long as Akamaya did, but not long after. Despite expectations, however, the relationship flourished. Akamaya was coaxed out to town more and more often. Saturdays now regularly found him at the dance hall, his moves stiff and out of fashion as his suits. He smiled broadly when he saw people staring, his amazement at his own good fortune clear on his face. When Akamaya could take the socialization no more, he would retreat back to Ramparts to recover in its dark and dusty halls. None but he had crossed the threshold of that house in 2 decades or more. Yet when Delilah asked, he brought her inside with barely a thought. She brushed aside his stammering, embarrassed apologies for the state of the house. "It's a lovely place," she told him firmly. "You must have had such a task keeping up with it yourself. Would you like me to help? I don't want to intrude, but if you're willing..." And of course he was, just as he was willing to do anything she suggested. Delilah smiled and thanked him and started small, with dusting rags and carpet beaters and cloths tied around their faces. They worked together, a hall at a time, Delilah's brilliant laugh lighting up the house even more than the sunshine streaming in through the newly cleaned windows. It was hard work, but in Delilah's company, the hours sped by. When they'd finished the whole house, from the strangely shaped attic rooms to the erratic expanse of the cellar, Akamaya thought that they might settle back into how things had been before, with trips to town and evenings settled in by the fire. Delilah, however, had other ideas. "There's a leak in the old nursery," she said, and Akamaya found himself scrambling up a ladder to nail shingles to the roof. "The porch roof is bowing," she told him, and he unearthed ancient tools from the groundskeeper's house, cleaned the rust off, and pressed them back into use to plane and place a new support column. This shutter was loose, this window was cracked, and 1,000 other things that had been slowly happening to the house over the years, as both Ramparts and its occupant had settled into neglect. It had never mattered when they matched each other, but with Delilah there to provide contrast, suddenly it all needed to be fixed. Delilah did not stand idly by while Akamaya did the work. She pulled her hair back, donned gloves, and pitched in, hauling and cutting and sanding along with him. Akamaya saw the amount of work she was doing to repair and restore his house, to restore him, and his heart swelled with love and admiration. He threw himself into the labors, determined to prove her confidence in him well-founded. Day by day, piece by piece, Ramparts grew brighter and stronger, inside and out. For the most part, Akamaya was happy to accede to Delilah's plans for repair and redecorating, but there were a few odd issues where he balked. The first was replacing the window treatments. Strangely, it wasn't the curtains that he objected to changing. They were heavy, musty, and decrepit, practically falling apart to the touch. Akamaya offered no objection, until Delilah added the curtain ties to the pile. "Leave those," he said. "They'll work fine on the new curtains." "These?" Delilah held up the ancient rope. It was twisted and gnarled, tangled back over itself in knots that had hardened to the permanence of stone. "You can't be serious. Look, they barely bend." She demonstrated, using her full strength to try to push the ends of the rope together. "See?" Delilah wiped her fingers together, held her hands out to her nose, and grimaced. "Plus, there's some kind of oil soaked in. Smells like dead fruit."
It's verbena, Hakamaya said. He sounded defensive. I like it. Look, they're your curtains. You want to tie them back up with tangled oily rope? It's all the same to me. I do appreciate everything you're doing around here, Delilah. You know that. It's just the ropes. They're important. Why? Hakamaya shrugged uncomfortably and offered no other response. Delilah eyed him curiously for a moment, then let it drop. She hung the new curtains, tied them back with the old ropes, and said no more about it. The next clash was over an overgrown hedgerow at a far edge of what had once been a garden. Delilah was detailing her plans to restore the entire area, to uncover the old paths, cut back the wild growth, and bring in new plants. We can take those trees out and put in some white cedars, Delilah was saying when Hakamaya interrupted her. The quick beam stays, he said, immediately looking apologetic for the insistence in his tone. They're all trunks and dead limbs. We can try to prune them back if you want, but I'd rather really just replace them. Quick beam, did you say? That's what my mother called them. Delilah pursed her lips. Was this garden important to her? If I'm overstepping, if I'm changing something that's meaningful to you, just say so. He shook his head. Just leave the hedgerow. The rest sounds wonderful. What is it you're not telling me, Hawk? For a moment, Hakamaya looked as if he might say something, but then he shook his head. I want to hear the rest of your idea for the garden. You'll have to tell me at some point, she pressed. Hakamaya smiled and said only, please, the garden. The topic did not arise again for several days. This time they were in the entrance hall, an altogether cheerier place since Delilah had begun her work. With the floor swept, the carpets cleaned, the curtains changed and the windows opened, ramparts looked happier and healthier than it had in decades. Still, to Delilah's eye, there was much yet to be done. That strange design over the front door, she began, but stopped as she saw the look in Hakamaya's eyes. She sighed. Never mind. I know. It stays. Hakamaya looked ashamed. I'm sorry. It's just, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. Try me. Hakamaya hesitated and looked her straight in the eyes. It's to guard against vampires, he said. Delilah's instinct was to laugh, but she could see in Hakamaya's face how fragile this moment was. She swallowed her reaction and said instead, tell me more. I had a brother, Hakamaya said, older. I don't remember him, not really. I was too young when he was taken. The vampires came for him and father both. Mother and I were away or they'd taken all of us. The house was empty when we returned. The struggle had been fierce, furniture overturned, paintings knocked off the walls, the doors hanging open. Neither of them was ever seen again. But why would that mean they were taken by vampires? Surely there were simpler explanations. Mother saw them. You said she wasn't home. Not then. She saw them later. The fight hadn't stopped inside the house. There were tracks in the back lawn, a scuffed trail, showing every place my father and brother had tried to break free. It led out to the garden, to their caves. My mother went into the caves, expecting to find villains. What she found were vampires. How did she know there were vampires? She said they were pallid, dried up. They wore black robes and arcane jewelry. Their cave was stacked with bones of all sorts, and the floor was thick with melted candle wax and spilled blood. Some of the blood was fresh, some of the bones still had meat on them. And they just let her go? They were asleep, stacked side by side like corpses laid out for a mass burial. She thought they were dead, until she saw one shift slightly as her light fell upon it. Why didn't she tell anyone? Why didn't they come back for you after you returned? Hakamaya indicated the symbol over the door. She warded the house. The sigil, the verbena rubbed into the knotted robes, those guard the entrances to ramparts. No vampire can pass by them. Why didn't they kill anyone else? Did she destroy them? No. Hakamaya smiled bleakly. She sealed them in. She planted the quick beam over the entrance to their caves. It's deadly to them, as bad as sunlight. She blocked them in and left them to starve. Every year the roots grow deeper, questing slowly toward the vampires that killed the rest of my family. Every year the vampire's prison grows slightly smaller. I don't know how long vampires can live without blood. Perhaps they're all dead by now. Perhaps they're still trapped down there. Mother just wanted to make sure they had a very long time to regret their final meal. You never looked? No. There's no way in without cutting away the quick beam, and I'm not about to do that. If they're still there, I hope they're still suffering. Delilah reached out and carefully took hold of Hakamaya's hands. Please, don't get angry with what I'm about to say. It's only a question. He cocked his head, waiting. Delilah took a deep breath and continued. Have you ever wondered if your mother was wrong? He shook his head. No, never. She described them in perfect detail. Yes, but what if it was a story? Maybe not a lie, not exactly. Not if she believed it herself. But everything you know about this, you know because she told you. What? No. He shook his head again, harder this time, as if trying to dislodge something. No. Obviously I had a father, and I have a memory or two of my brother, and the house. I remember what ramparts looked like that day. That memory is crystal clear. I was so frightened because Mother wouldn't stop wailing, and I didn't understand what was wrong. I wanted her to comfort me, but she was the cause, and I didn't know what to do. I remember the disarray. It felt like my whole world had fallen apart inside and out. Besides, my father and brother weren't taken. Where did they go? He challenged. Maybe they just went. Went where? What do you mean? Went. As in left. Maybe your father took your brother and went somewhere else. To live. Maybe the house was in shambles because he'd taken things in a hurry. Maybe the vampires were just a story your mother told herself because it was easier than the truth. She wouldn't do that. Not on purpose, Hawk. People's minds do strange things. I never knew your mother, but you did. Think about her behavior throughout your life. Divorce yourself from your emotions. Imagine you were a stranger looking at it. What was she like? Is it possible I'm right? Could this fit? Hakamaya's hands hung limply against Delilah's palms. After a few seconds, they fell away entirely. I need to be alone, he said quietly. Hawk, I need to be alone, please. His eyes were downcast. He would not look at Delilah. Hawk, I'm so... Please! Delilah reached up to give him a hug. He was stiff and unyielding in her embrace. She held it for a moment, hoping for a reaction, then let go. I'll wait for you to call, she said, then turned and left. Hakamaya did not walk her to the door. It was more than a week before they spoke again. When Hakamaya finally came to call on Delilah again, his face was unreadable. He carried a bouquet of flowers and a wrapped package, which seemed like good signs. But the careful pace at which he delivered his words suggested a prepared speech. As he spoke, Delilah busied herself arranging the flowers in a vase. It gave her something to do other than scrutinize his face for clues as to the words to come. Delilah, I've had a lot to think about this week. You called into doubt facts which I had never considered questioning. I've had to upend a lot of what I thought I knew, re-examining everything. It's been a challenging and often painful process, and one which I suspect I'm still only beginning. I could not have undertaken this journey without you. Even if I had thought about taking the first step, I would have not had the courage or stamina to move forward. I was on a slow slide to senescence. You saved me from that. I have much more work to do. I want you with me for all of this. He held the package out to her. Delilah, will you marry me? She took it curiously. It was thin and oblong, perhaps 2 feet long and 1 inch thick. I'm told a ring is more traditional. Open it, he suggested. Her hands were already at work on the packaging. Inside was a wooden plank. Delilah stared at it, puzzled, until she turned it over. On the front was the warding sigil from Rampart's front door. I took it down, he said. There are no vampires. Yes, Delilah said. Yes? Yes. Yes, I will marry you. Akamaya swept her up in his arms, pressing her close. The board clattered to the floor. And all I have is yours. The ancestral lands? Delilah teased. Quick beam and all. Your house? You are its mistress. Your heart? Without question. He kissed her passionately. She responded with ardor. Sometime later, they broke apart. Come back to Rampart's, Akamaya told her. The house misses you. I'll come by tonight, she assured him. We'll celebrate. How would you feel about having a few people over? I might hate it, he answered, honestly. But for you, absolutely. Thank you. I promise it'll be brief. I can do that for you. My dear. He kissed her hand in an oddly formal gesture, bowed, and left. Delilah watched from the window until he was out of sight, smiling to herself. When he was gone, she went down to the basement of her house. The far wall had a large fissure in it. The crack was almost a finger wide and opened into something deep and black beyond. It's done, she said. A sibilant voice drifted forth from the crack. Afraid? Trees still block your exit. They are now my trees, and I will remove them. When? Tonight. And the scion will be there for you. The protections. Gone. Good. Purred the voice. Good. My payment? As promised. There was a sound of metal sliding slowly over stone. Then a dirty gold coin slid slowly out of the crack. It fell to the ground with a musical ring, spinning and settling as another coin eased through the crack behind it. Then another, and another. A slow golden spring trickling forth from her wall. Delilah gathered her coins together as they fell, making sure none rolled away. So many, she said. Almost to herself. There are many disregarded things below the ground, answered the voice. We've had nothing but time to find them. We've freed them, and now you shall free us. Tonight, Delilah agreed. Tonight, hissed a chorus of voices. I hope you enjoyed The Depths of Trust by Micah Edwards as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed what you've heard tonight, I'd like to remind you one last time that tonight's featured authors can be found by visiting our website. Just visit simplyscarypodcast.com/authors/Micah-Edwards. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/authors/MICAH-EDWARDS. Support him with a book purchase or by reading his most recent work on Reddit and Amazon. Thanks again for your support of this program and of tonight's featured author. As a reminder, if you decide to give tonight's talented author's story as a read, please consider leaving him a quality review and a kind word, or a thoughtful public comment and an upvote. And be sure to let him know you heard about him here on this program, and that me, Otis Jarry, sent you. It means more to me than you can imagine, and I'm sure Micah would very much appreciate it as well. Thanks again for your support of this show and of tonight's featured author. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 a month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Jarry channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Jarry. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Jarry. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Jarry channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.